This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Four-day school week. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
At least 600 school districts in 22 states have dropped Friday classes from the schedule in order to save money and attract teachers. Here are the pros and cons.
Could artificial intelligence return Senate confirmation hearings to civilized debates? A tech expert thinks so.
From sports, the NFL team that offers fans the best value for their entertainment dollar.
And gone is our obsession with the good life. Now retirement is about a good life.
So when we were being brought up, people talked about the good life. They talked about, you know, being able to afford all these material possessions. They talked about, you know, being able to come home at the end of the day and have these great moments of relaxation. You know, but I think for a lot of people, all those material goods didn't prove so satisfying.
Jonathan Clements at HumbleDollar.com on a culture change about personal finance. He's here later in the hour. We are all various things at once, right? Maybe a mother, a southerner, a millennial, maybe a member of the middle class, or perhaps your Twitter bio introduces you as a husband, a Texan, and an engineer. In an era of acrid partisanship, how do political beliefs figure into these identities? Emily Badgerew, who writes for Upshot at the New York Times, looked at a brief survey. Emily, what'd you look at?
You know, we were talking about this topic at the Upshot because we came across some survey data from the early 2000s where people were asked, okay, here's a list of identities. Which one is most important to you? And, you know, the options are your gender, your race, your religion, the political party that you affiliate with, the part of the country that you grew up in. And, you know, we were sort of surprised by how Americans have answered this question in the past. Religion ranks really, really highly for a lot of people. It's one of the most prominent things. You know, sort of people's family affiliations, whether you identify as a mother or a father or a wife, ranks really highly. And politics were like all the way down at the bottom of this list. And we sort of suspected that perhaps we would see something different if we asked people this question again today, because this feels like a moment when everyone is thinking about politics, you know, when politics are sort of pervading everything around us.
Yeah.
So we resurveyed this question with about 2,000 people and found once again that politics really aren't as important to people as we thought if you sort of ask them this question about, you know, thinking about your own identity, which parts of your identity are most important to you.
That's interesting. Because as you found out, I guess, from the survey, as you say in the piece, most Americans don't live and breathe politics the way Washington news fiends do.
Right. We have to remind ourselves of this constantly. You know, those of us who write about these things for a living, that most people out in America are not as obsessed with them as we are.
So what other changes, I guess, from the last time survey versus the this time survey?
So one thing that has really changed, and it's been accelerating over the last several decades, is that a lot of these other identities that, you know, are not political in nature, your religion, whether you are religious or non-religious, your race, they have come into alignment with your political identity to a degree that really was not the case, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. So, for instance, you know, if I told you in the 1990s, that I am a non-religious white woman, that wouldn't really tell you a whole lot about my politics. But now it is increasingly the case that non-religious people are much more likely to be Democrats. Religious people are much more likely to be Republicans. You know, we're seeing a much clearer sort of alignment along racial lines, where the Republican Party is much more heavily represented among whites. Non-whites are much more heavily leaning toward the Democratic Party. So we see this along race, along religion. We're increasingly starting to see it in education, too, in that, you know, more educated voters are now starting to lean toward the Democratic Party more. So, you know, that sort of suggests that, you know, even if you say that your political identity is not that important to you, all of these other kinds of identity that are important to you increasingly kind of tell us about your politics.
Wow. We're speaking with Emily Badger, writer for Upshot at The New York Times, and she's written a piece entitled Americans Say Their Politics Don't Define Them, but it's complicated. You said, too, people even change their policy preferences depending on which identities they're thinking about. What does that mean?
Well, so you have lots of different identities at any given moment. You know, you have a radio show, you are a man, you know, you're from a particular part of the country, you affiliate with your hometown, and whichever one of those is important to you may sort of change by the moment depending on what you're doing or what you're thinking about. So political scientists have found that, you know, people's policy preferences can change if you get them to think about certain identities over other identities. So, for example, you know, Democrats are more likely than Republicans to support things like sentencing reform, or, you know, to say that they want to spend money on social services, and that's more important to them than worrying about the federal deficit. But political scientists have done experiments where they've shown that if you get Democrats to sort of think about the fact that they're parents first and foremost, you actually see their views shift to become a little bit more conservative on those kinds of questions. So that suggests that, you know, identity is this very kind of fluid thing that shifts depending on, you know, the context that you're in, what you're thinking about, but that your policy preferences might shift as well. I think it's a little bit sort of surprising to us because most of us tend to think that our policy preferences are these very sort of well thought out logical conclusions that we reach.
Thanks, Emily. Emily Badger, she writes for Upshot at the New York Times. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. How cool would this have been back in the day? A four-day school week. The Wall Street Journal says more schools are adopting a four-day schedule to save money and attract teachers. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
It saves money and it retains teachers. Four-day school schedules are starting to spread across the country. Tonnell Hobbs of the Wall Street Journal joins us now to talk about this trend. How widespread is this four-day school week?
You know, it's really growing. You know, we actually reached out to every state, all 50 states in D.C., and I came back with 600, at least 600 school districts are doing this in at least 22 states. And just a decade ago, that number was about 120 school districts. So it's really growing. It's getting more and more popular. And it's, you know, it's been really on the western side of the map, but now it's going east.
Why has it been mostly in the western part of the state so far?
You know, that's a really good question. And what from just talking to different educators, it looks like it's more of a geographical situation there where you have, you know, more districts spread out, more rural districts, because this is something that started in rural districts and is still very dominant in rural districts. And there's just a lot more rural districts out west.
Tonnell, why did the rural districts decide to go to the four-day week?
It all goes to saving money. And when you're in a rural district and you're really spread out, you can spend a good chunk of your budget on transportation because everybody's really spread out. And so initially, it's always about saving money. And then they started noticing other benefits like, wow, you know, teachers are really attracted to having a three-day weekend. This might help with recruiting. In some of the rural areas, sometimes it's hard to recruit teachers out there.
I also saw one of the benefits in your story as fewer absences. That would be a huge one.
Yes, and that's another unexpected benefit that some of these districts initially going into it to save money are saying, wow, you know what? It really does help for the kids to get three-day weekends, and, you know, they're showing up. And the same thing with teachers. You know, they're noticing fewer teacher absences.
We're speaking with Tonnell Hobbs of the Wall Street Journal. Now, if you're shrinking the week to 4 days, do you add hours to the other days?
Yes, that's what they're doing. They're adding hours. And, you know, in some of these districts, they had already met the minimum required hours for instruction. So, you know, they might add anywhere from 15 minutes a day to 90 minutes a day. It just depends on where they were at when they started, when they were on 5 days. If they were already exceeding the hours, there is just basically adding time at the end of that day.
Now, does each state decide its own hours and or days? I know here in New Jersey, kids have to be in school a certain number of days, not hours.
Yes, and exactly. And that... And it's easier for states, and you're right, each state does decide, you know, how many hours kids are going to be in school. And I noticed that the states that have the 4 days are those states that basically look at hours. They don't care, you know, how many days you're in school. They just want you, you know, to be in school for the year for 1,080 hours or whatever. And there are some states that still do base it on how many days you're in school. And those are the states that it's a bit harder to go to 4 day on those states because they look at days instead of hours. The ones that look at hours is, you know, we don't care what your schedule is. Just make sure your kids, you know, have this many hours of instruction for the year.
I would think that there would be some opposition to this plan from parents who have to scramble around to find care for their kid on that empty day.
Yes, and that's always the big issue, daycare. Daycare on that day. And what I have found is a lot of these districts that go to 4 day, they typically have something in place, whether they open up some of the schools on that Friday and they offer like a discounted daycare, and some of them actually offer free daycare, or there's nonprofits that have like relatively cheap daycare, and the school district might provide the meals to those nonprofits. In some cases, the school district actually might open up on that Friday just to serve meals, because there are some very poor communities where that might be the only meal the child might be getting, you know, during that school day period. So daycare has been a really big issue. But, you know, I went to Colorado where more than 50% of the districts use 4 day. And in talking to those parents, there were a lot of them I talked to that initially did not want it, but then they just grew to love it. It's, you know, it's, oh, you know, it lets them take kind of a mini vacation if they want to, you know, get away for an extended weekend with the family. And a lot of parents start out not liking it, but they end up liking it.
Antonelle, I guess the biggest question, the $20,000 question, what kind of an impact does this have on learning? Do we know yet?
You know, and I've looked at study after study, and from what I can see, academics, just based on these studies, academics are not suffering under the 4 day. And there's actually school districts that say that they've noticed higher test scores because the kids just come back well rested and ready to learn, and they're missing fewer days, so they're in school more. That's how they feel. But academics, we haven't really seen studies that show that kids do horrible. It just seems to be like, you know, academics really just don't seem to be suffering right now, according to these studies.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal education reporter Tonelle Hobbs. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for 4 straight years, that's pure Michigan. Contact MichiganBusiness.org. The stock of Canadian cannabis company Tilray has been on a wild ride in recent months ahead of the legalization of recreational marijuana in Canada this past week. And there's more good news for cannabis-friendly Canadians. In Canada, getting high off marijuana doesn't come at a high cost, at least compared with the U.S. Cannabis is significantly cheaper in Canada than in parts of the U.S. where it is legal, according to a recent report from the data analysis firm Priceonomics. MarketWatch reporter Jacob Passy has been looking at this report. Jacob, what are we learning?
They basically looked at, you know, the price of marijuana in different cities across the U.S. and Canada and compared it. And what they found is that cannabis is about 30% cheaper in Canada than it is in the U.S., and that was before it was legalized. So what the report basically said was because cannabis was more widely available in Canada because it's been legal for medical uses for many years now, and so there's a wider range of dispensaries, there's a wider range of producers in Canada than there is here in the U.S. And so the researchers basically said because of that that wider range of production, in Canada they can supply it more cheaply. You know, whereas here in the U.S., except for the states where it's legal, it's illegal at the federal level, and so that drives up the cost here in the U.S.
All right, so medical marijuana has been around a long time in Canada, correct?
Yeah, it's been around since 2001. So, you know, they have a very large legal cannabis industry in Canada. And, you know, that industry was pretty easily able to, you know, kind of transition to wider legality in Canada. So, you know, because they already had that kind of foundation for legal cannabis, you know, it made things easier. And you know, if you look at the videos and stuff coming in from Canada, folks are, you know, kind of easily able to go in and out of the dispensaries and pick up what they want.
We're speaking with Jacob Passy, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch. He's written a piece entitled "Why Americans Pay More for Weed Than Canadians." What's the cost breakdown? Is it done by ounce, I guess?
Yeah, so in Canada, it's about $28 per eighth of an ounce. That was the measurement they used. Whereas here in the U.S., it's about $40 for an eighth of an ounce. So, you know, for a full ounce, you know, multiply that out, it'd be about like $320 here in the U.S. But that varies, you know, from city to city. And surprisingly, where it was most expensive was in San Francisco. Medical marijuana is legal in California, but nevertheless, you know, there are, you know, in the U.S., where marijuana is legal, you know, a lot of those states are still having to set up dispensaries. They're still having to, you know, set up a whole, you know, kind of ecosystem for the industry because, you know, they have to do it within that state. They can't cross state lines because it's illegal at the federal level. And so that makes things harder and drives up the cost.
If, let's say, the U.S. were to legalize it on the federal level and, let's say, all 50 states followed suit and legalized marijuana, does that change perhaps the pricing structure or supply and demand, things like that, and we would compete more with Canada?
Yeah, no. So if you know, if it was made legal at the federal level, you know, you could expect the cost to go down pretty quickly because it would be much easier to produce in the states that already have legalized it at the state level. You know, they would be able to ship it across state lines, so that would drop prices in other states. And we could, you know, get it from Canada where there is this, you know, very robust cannabis industry already in place.
Thanks, Jacob. MarketWatch personal finance reporter Jacob Passy. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. No one compliments you when their paycheck is correct, but make one mistake and you risk alienating your entire workforce. With Kronos, we make sure your payroll is done right the first time, from punch to paycheck. Embedded checklists, simplified workflows, a single source of truth. HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping in one unified system, all with a proven implementation approach and simplified, transparent pricing. Learn more at kronos.com/payroll. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and advanced manufacturing. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Glad you could spend some time with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka coming up this half hour. Some new thinking about retirements. Also for Halloween, the scary fickle toddler when it comes to costumes. And in sports, the NFL team offering the best return on your investment dollar. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. If you watch the confirmation process for new Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, you may have been concerned that each political party might have a hand in corrupting the highest court in the land. If that happens, you effectively destroy the Constitution, and by doing so, the country. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group, has a look at how artificial intelligence could help the process, since it has a goal of fixing problems. Rob, explain.
Well, so that's what really got me worked up. I think a lot of people watched that confirmation process and kind of realized the process itself was severely broken. An AI, with the power of an AI is it's trained correctly, is that it's unbiased. It could do a preliminary investigation of any claim against a candidate based on publicly available and private information and do so in both a secure and confidential fashion, so neither the complainant nor the candidate was put at risk. And so much of the drama we saw on television, which damaged both participants significantly, could have been done ahead of time, and then a decision could be reached with regard to whether or not the candidate or the complainant was viable without doing so much damage. So we pretty much get the same outcome, but the damage to both the parties would be, and to the appearance of the court, would have been substantially reduced. And that's what an AI is really for. It helps you get to the meat of a problem, provides you with advice on how to resolve the problem, and does so without this massive amount of drama we seem to be enduring on pretty much every major decision.
All right, so how could it potentially handle, though, accusations from the 1980s?
Well, I think that what it would do is it would go against and certainly would take the evidence that was presented and would determine whether that evidence reached the threshold of a decision. So in other words, if let's take this particular case, we had a complainant that said that there was an assault, an attempted rape, but no rape kit, no location, no time, no all the things that would fill out a case, even on the next day had it happened the day before, that would allow a prosecutor to bring the case forward, wasn't in existence. And so the AI would likely come back very quickly and say, okay, we need these elements, otherwise there's no point in proceeding because there's no substance here. And so it would allow, say, when Senator Feinstein got the initial note way back in July, it would say, okay, this doesn't meet the threshold, you're going to need these five things, you're going to need to go out and get these five things before this has to proceed. And of course, as we saw, none of those things had been achieved by the time it finally went on to television. And so either it meets the threshold or it doesn't meet the threshold. And if it doesn't, it would detail what you needed to do to get there. And then if you didn't want to do it, then that's your decision. You can certainly still go forward and try to disrupt these people's lives. But if you wanted to be successful, it would allow you to prioritize your resources to see if you could find these other elements and make the case rather than just get everybody angry.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. He's written a piece about how artificial intelligence could help clean up something like the Senate confirmation process for a Supreme Court justice. I guess, too, though, there could be accusations of bias in how the AI was programmed, right? Or how data was input.
Always the case. So that's one of the reasons why I point to IBM in the piece, because IBM early on has popped up with a series of procedures and practices that allow you to create an AI that's unbiased. And realize that a biased AI is problematic on a whole bunch of fronts, because we're increasingly going to be depending on AIs to drive our cars, make financial decisions for us, make medical decisions for us. And so if you don't eliminate the bias at the front end, suddenly you're going to be getting procedures that you don't need, or worse, could make you sicker. You're going to have cars that drive off bridges, and Lord knows what's going to happen if you've got a robot that decides to go insane.
All right, thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. Reminder, by the way, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter with the username @ThisMorningShow. You can follow me directly on Twitter as well with the username @GordonDeal. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. Welcome aboard. Most folks neither live below the poverty line nor count themselves among the one percenters. Nonetheless, there are plenty of signs that many American families are having a rough time financially. A Federal Reserve study found that 44% of Americans either couldn't cover a $400 financial emergency or, to do so, would need to borrow or sell something. Among households headed by someone age 55 and older, 29% have nothing for retirement. Where does that leave us? Here's Jonathan Clements, editor and founder of HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, how do you see this?
So when we were being brought up, people talked about the good life. They talked about, you know, being able to afford all these material possessions. They talked about, you know, being able to come home at the end of the day and have these great moments of relaxation, you know, watch the TV or go on that wonderful vacation. But I think for a lot of people, all those material goods didn't prove so satisfying, and those moments of relaxation often left us feeling bored and restless. Instead, today when I talk to people, they seem less interested in the good life and more interested in a good life. What do I mean by a good life? What I mean is one that's focused on spending time with friends and family, on doing work that is fulfilling, and where we have this sense of financial security. Instead of running on the hedonic treadmill trying to get that next promotion, pay raise, and purchase, we're focusing more on being content in the moment.
I know that that's often easier said than done, but you did put together some concrete examples on how to get on that path. I know you got them from your book. Kind of recreate them for us, if you would.
One of the most powerful things I believe to do is to create a wish list and put it up on the refrigerator. List the things that you want to buy in the months and years ahead. One of the things that we know from the research is that we're really bad at figuring out what will make us happy. If we make a wish list and we revisit it often, we revise it over time as we decide, maybe that isn't so important to me. That does seem like something I really want to do. We're likely to end up being much smarter in how we use our dollars, and that means that we'll get more money, more happiness out of the wealth that we've earned.
I thought your next point was interesting, too, about deciding or writing down which moments you enjoy the most during a typical week and which you dislike the most. Then what?
And then you can say, all right, these are the things that I really want to do with my time, and these are the things that I really don't want to do with my time. And if you have the cash to spare, what you should do is you should hire people to do the things you really dislike, and that should free you up to spend time on the things you really enjoy. So if you really don't like cutting the grass, hire some kid to do it, if you can find a kid to do it these days, and instead use that time for your favorite hobby.
Right. We're speaking with Jonathan Clements. He's the founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com, also author of a new book called From Here to Financial Happiness. We're talking about the difference between living the good life and a good life, getting away from the material things. Another point you make is about eliminating things that cause you financial anxiety.
A lot of us do things often impulsively that end up causing us financial stress. We spend too much. You know, we commit to work projects that end up devouring huge quantities of time. What you should try to do is think harder about your financial life and figure out what it is that can reduce some of these financial worries. So, for instance, you know, if carrying credit card debt is causing you a lot of anxiety, try to get that debt paid off. If you find that you're living paycheck to paycheck, maybe you just need to put a couple thousand dollars in a savings account that's linked to your checking account. That way, you know that if it's tight at the end of the month, you can just shift a little money out of your savings account and into your checking account.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, editor and founder of HumbleDollar.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Hey, glad you're with us. Hordes of parents are haunted by their children's indecision over what costume to wear on Halloween, one of their favorite days of the year. Those who wait until the last minute take the risk there won't be any of the hottest get-ups left. But buy or make a costume too early, and fickle kids change their minds. Are you the parent that will make the switch or force them to stick with the original? Here's Wall Street Journal reporter Leslie Brody. Leslie, set this up.
Some parents think they're being really efficient and they buy Halloween costumes or make them when they're on sale back in the summer, but then they find their kids change their mind by the time Halloween rolls around. But the parents who wait till the last minute sometimes worry that there won't be the exact right costume that their kid wants left anymore. So parents play a tricky game of figuring out when to listen to a child's desires because little kids change their minds all the time.
Did you figure out, by the way, which types of parents were the most likely to cave late in October and scramble to get the change of mind costume?
No, I found pushovers and tough parents of all stripes. But one really made me laugh when she said that, for her kids, the costume she buys is what you're wearing. It's like a marriage. You're committed. You're going to need a lawyer or a body bag to get out of it.
That was a hilarious quote. I mean, these days, right, it's not the same where you just throw on some makeup or, you know, as you mentioned, like grab a white sheet back in the day and be a ghost. I mean, you're spending the money these days.
Well, the average, according to the National Retail Federation, is $87 per person for Halloween celebrants, but that would also include cards and candy and costumes and decorations and all. It's about $9 billion across the country. And some parents and some kids do make their own costumes, though. Put a shout-out for those who take old Amazon boxes and make them into dinosaurs.
What is there a particular range of age where the mind changing right before Halloween seems to be most popular?
Well, Tova Klein, who's an expert in toddlers at Barnard College, she thinks the preschool years are particularly full of surprises, because she says that young children love to pretend and they live in the present. They don't have the same sense of time or dates on a calendar that adults do. So for her, she says that's a beautiful clash between the young child's world and a parent's world. But for parents, it can be tears and tantrums and tricky and, you know, stressful.
Thanks, Leslie. Wall Street Journal reporter Leslie Brody. It is 7 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Don't forget to check out podcasts of our program. You can find them for this show this weekend, or also our weekday programs. You can find them on our website, which is thismorningwithgordondeal.com. Anyone who's attended a professional sports event in the past few years knows how expensive it can be. Is the price a little more worth it if your team wins? Recent research takes a look at which NFL fans get the most for their football money. MarketWatch says the best deal goes to Carolina Panthers fans, who not only get to watch games in a warmer climate, but spend the least per team win. At the other end of the spectrum, Chicago Bears fans freeze their butts off at many home games, and they pay the most per win. The research was conducted by the online Masters in Data Science program at the University of California, Berkeley. It considered the cost of a game as one ticket, stadium parking, one hot dog, and one beer. So if you go to a game with someone else via car and drink more than one beer, these are modest estimates. The win percentage, by the way, covers the past five regular seasons. The next teams on the value list behind the Panthers: the Chiefs, Bengals, Cardinals, and Falcons to round out the top five. Jets, Giants, Niners, Redskins, and Bears were considered the worst deals. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.